Blog Talk Radio.
I'm always excited. I'm always ready to do my best to communicate the truth of God's word, to talk to you about what's happening in Iran and all over the world. Today, we're going to go behind the scenes to the latest novel. It's a fictional novel with a lot of truth, though, by Joel Rosenberg. It's called The Third Target, and it talks about the rise of ISIS and how that relates really to Bible prophecy. It's going to be a very interesting interview segment with Joel Rosenberg. I also am featuring Joel. He was just recently at a prophecy conference at Greg Laurie's church. We're going to get some sound bites from that as well. Also later on, from the Janet Markle Show, these are some very, very timely, interesting interviews, one by Gary Kaa and the Iran nuclear deal. We're always going to talk about this simply because we have less than 60 days to find out just what Congress is willing to do about this. I hope and pray they vote this down. This is a disaster. We need to bring our four Americans home absolutely as soon as possible. Also today on The Cross in the Desert, we're going to feature a very interesting segment, something I wasn't aware of till my dear friend Paymanay told me about it. We're going to talk about Iranians selling their kidneys in Iran for money because of the poor economic conditions. There is no waiting list. There are really no dialysis patients in Iran. But let's go behind the scenes and find out the pros and cons of this practice in Iran. You won't want to miss that. Also, going to read my new blog about the Iranian nuclear deal. But I want to talk to you a few minutes about something I'm just so excited about. Just yesterday, I published my 10th book, Prisoner of Her Culture, Sakina's Fight for Freedom. It's now available on Kindle in the Amazon Kindle store. Really, really excited about that. In a couple of days, I'll get the paperback. I will look it over and approve it. And most likely, within the next week or so, it also will be available on paperback. This is the first time I've written about Pakistan. It is the story of the plight of Pakistani women, much like Iranian women. They are desperate. They have no freedom, and they are in a culture of shame and honor, and they must do everything their family outlines for them. They have no choice of their own. And if it's a career choice, it has to be family approved. It has to be family approved who they marry. So in this new book, it takes place in two continents, one in the Middle Eastern continent, in Pakistan, and the other in Key West, Florida. Yes, you're going to ask yourself, what on earth are you taking characters from Pakistan to Key West? Well, you'll find out when you read it. But Sakina is 16 years old when she is the victim of a quote-unquote forced, if you will, arranged marriage. Her sister, Mahtab, also. In the setting of the book, Mahtab becomes an unwilling, reluctant bride because the family has a dispute with another family. It's gone on for years, and one of the ways they settle this dispute, and this happens in Pakistan, is that they agree to have their daughter marry their son, and they exchange dowries back and forth. And somehow this rift, this confrontation is healed. But again, a young girl has to marry someone she doesn't love, and she's the victim, a reluctant bride in a forced marriage. And so that's just one of the things that happens in the book. There are many, many things. I'm just kind of whetting your appetite, though. I hope, I pray that you will get it and you will read it. I'm so excited about this because as I publish this book, I am clearing my shelf of any writing for a long time because now I'm engaged in very specific research for my next publication, which is Rehana Jabari's biography. That's going to take a lot of time. I need a lot of prayer on that. It's a difficult, challenging process. It's not like I have Rehana's family sitting next to me, that I can interview them, take notes, I can talk with them at length. Because Sholay, Rehana's mother, doesn't know English very well, she sends information to Paymon A, and Paymon A translates and sends it back to me. And so this is a long process, but it is something that is groundbreaking for me. I've never written a biography before. This is not like a novel or anything I've ever written before, and I'm really, really excited about what can happen in this novel. The whole idea behind it is to bring healing and justice to Rehana's family, her parents, for the incredibly difficult ordeal that they have suffered. And this October, believe it or not, in just a couple of months, will be the one-year anniversary when Rehana was hanged in Tehran, October 25th, 2014. So please be in prayer for this project. This is a monumental project, but I'm very excited about what God can do with this book. And thank you so much for all of you who read my books, who see my postings. Thank you so much for your support and prayers. Well, just this past Tuesday, the U.S. Senate sent a strong message to Iran and the Obama administration by unanimously voting in favor of a resolution calling on the Obama administration to, in the words of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, quote, to use the tools it has in pursuit of what should be a strong bipartisan goal, securing the release of American hostages in Iran, not detained hostages. The resolution, it was sponsored by Senator James Risch of Idaho, the home state of Pastor Saeed Abedini and where his wife Nagmeh and two children still live. And it shows that Congress has not forgotten about Pastor Saeed and the other Americans wrongfully imprisoned in Iran. We're going to listen to Mitch McConnell talk about this resolution right now on the cross in the desert.
Later this afternoon, we'll take up another Iran-related measure that I hope will pass with similar bipartisan enthusiasm. The junior senator from Idaho's resolution is simple. It calls on the administration to use the tools it has in pursuit of what should be a bipartisan goal, securing the release of American citizens being held as hostages by the regime in Iran. One of those Americans, Shahid Abedini, has reportedly been held prisoner for what would appear to be the supposed crime of attempting to build and operate an orphanage. The supposed crime of building and operating an orphanage. Beaten, denied access to medical care, and locked away in solitary confinement. That's apparently how the Iranian regime deals with those who dare to show love and compassion to others. No American should find this acceptable. Just as no American should find it acceptable to unjustly imprison a reporter or a grandson coming to see his grandmother, I think we'd all agree that at the very least the American government should not be rewarding Iran for its disgraceful human rights abuses, that we should not be granting Iran access to the funding it desires to further its nuclear weapons program and terrorist proxies while this exploitation continues. So I call on every senator to join us in standing up for human rights. Let's pass Senator Risch's legislation later this afternoon.
That is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And in light of the upcoming Senate review of the nuclear deal with Iran, Tuesday was a very important statement that the senators are prioritizing the freedom of Pastor Saeed and the other U.S. citizens that are imprisoned in Iran. These are the same U.S. senators who will review and vote on any finalized nuclear deal reached with Iran. Now, as the United States and Iran reach to the negotiating table this week, it is vitally important that our leaders, regardless of party, do all they can to release and secure the release of Saeed and the other Americans before any deal is finalized and approved by Congress. Now, if you scroll down my page, you're going to see a picture of Saeed in relationship to this resolution. And I just want you to sign the latest petition demanding no deal with Iran, no deal with Iran without Pastor Saeed. Please go to my Facebook page. Scroll down. I will probably put it back up today so it's easier to find. But if you scroll down, you will see a picture of Saeed. Click on it, and there will be a petition linked to it from the American Center of Law and Justice. In fact, in 2 weeks from today, I will have the honor and privilege of interviewing Nagme Abedini and Tiffany Barnes from the American Center of Law and Justice. Nagme will be here, and we will talk about this nuclear deal, her thoughts, her emotions, and the upcoming prayer vigil. Yes, we're doing this again. This is the third prayer vigil now. For 3 years, all across the country, Christians have engaged in vigils crying out for the release of Saeed and all prisoners that are being held in Iran, including Amir Hekmati and Jason, the Washington journalist, as well as Robert Stevenson. We are doing this until they come home. I know that Nagme just can't believe another year has gone by. Rebecca's birthday is coming up, and I remember a story not too long ago where Nagme shared that Saeed had a specific dream that he was home in time for Rebecca's birthday. Oh, how we pray that this dream becomes a reality. I'll talk to you about a very interesting Facebook page that my friend Giddy shared with me just yesterday. And it's a page that asks a very important question. It says, what would you like to ask President Obama and the United States Congress about the recent nuclear deal with the theocratic regime of Iran? Now, this page, as far as I understand, was put together by some Iranians. And the traffic on the page is Iranians. They actually have some videos that you can do and actually asking President Obama. So what I want to do, I want to read to you three of the questions that I found interesting on this page. One was from an Iranian man, no names mentioned. He asks, under Rouhani, at least 753 people were reportedly executed in 2014, including 25 women and 13 minors, making the highest rate of execution for 12 years. Adding the 252 executions as of March 2015, Iran has executed more than 1,000 people since January 2014, and that number is rising every day, three people a day. So his question to President Obama is, how can we deal with this type of government? What benefit outweighs this sort of cost of life? A very, very good question. Another one, Mr. Obama, how reliable and trustworthy can a regime be for keeping promises when it had begun its work with taking American hostages and chanting the slogan of death to America, execution and torture for its own people? How can Americans trust this regime when you know most obligations of this regime based on religious laws can be changed overnight for its own benefits? Does this mean, Mr. President, that you can reach an agreement with ISIS too, with all the cruelty that has been happening? So human right has no meaning for you, or it's for your own people? Very good question. A very good point. How can we trust this cruel and brutal regime? Now, this is kind of a statement question. This is the last one I'm going to read. Mr. President, the duplicitous policies and Janus-faced behavior of the Islamic Republic of Iran makes it a very difficult regime to trust. As you may know, the amount of executions and egregious human rights violations committed in this country have only increased since the so-called moderate government of President Rouhani. As a community diaspora, we Iranians would like to know if human rights will become the new bottom line, and that somehow your administration should have integrated the issue of human rights into the Iran nuclear deal. In other words, Mr. Obama, why weren't human rights at the center of this deal? How can you trust the behavior of this regime? Shouldn't human rights become the new bottom line? And of course, you heard what President Obama said. This deal has nothing to do with curbing their behavior, even supporting terrorists or human rights. It's unbelievable, isn't it? Well, that's an interesting page. It's a Facebook page you want to check out. I love the questions there. It's a question on Facebook page. What would you like to ask President Obama and the United States Congress about the recent nuclear deal with the theocratic regime of Iran? Very interesting page. I'm glad to see that page is up on Facebook. Well, what I want to do now, I want to take us behind the scenes to the newest book by Joel Rosenberg, The Third Target, and he will discuss the implications of the rise of ISIS in his new fictional novel and what that means for Bible prophecy. We're going to listen to Joel Rosenberg right now on the cross in the desert.
Though airstrikes seem to be keeping Islamic militants from gaining additional ground in the Middle East, a new fictional thriller hitting bookstores this week examines the terrifying question, what if ISIS obtained chemical weapons? The Third Target author and former advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Joel Rosenberg, joins us with another thrilling book. And having done extensive research on this for years, he joins us now. Joel, always good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, Shannon.
And, you know, we always talk about those of us who enjoy your books. Critics and lovers of your books alike admit that you seem to be very prescient. You almost have a gift for writing about things as they're unfolding and as they come in the future. And I know you had started the threads, the idea of this novel, before Americans knew what ISIS was, and it seems like it was an exact match for the story you wanted to try to tell.
Well, I try to write novels about threats that could be coming up over the horizon, you know, and to give us a sense of what could that be like if it were to happen, you know, God forbid. I'm not trying to predict things in the novel that I write. I'm trying to warn and sort of take people into this world. I spent time with former CIA director Jim Woolsey from the Clinton years, former CIA director Porter Goss from the Bush years, former head of Mossad Danny Atom and others, asking them, what do you worry about? This was a year ago. And what keeps you up at night? And they said ISIS and the threat that this could be metamorphosed from Al-Qaeda in Iraq to something really horrific. And it's gone much faster, honestly, than I imagined. I was thinking this was a five-year out from us threat, and that's why I wanted to write The Third Target. But it's moving much faster and more dangerously than I even had anticipated.
Well, and I know that you live and work quite a bit in that region, and there are concerns about many of the other countries and states that are there in the region. We've got word today of ISIS trying to get a foothold in Lebanon now. They want to establish some type of bases there as well. But there are so many other countries that this is the reality of what lives on their border every day. Do you address that in the book as well?
Well, yeah. The novel is about a New York Times reporter, a foreign correspondent, who hears a rumor that ISIS has captured a cache of chemical weapons in Syria. And he and his colleagues sneak into Syria, try to interview the commander of ISIS on the ground. And what emerges is an enormous threat, a genocidal threat. The question that the reporter is trying to figure out is, who is ISIS going to hit next, right? Because they're already trying to bring down the government of Syria. ISIS is trying to bring down the government of Iraq. So what's the next target? What's the third target? Is that the United States? Is it Israel? Is it Lebanon? Is it Jordan? You know, there's a lot of options available to the Islamic State, and they're a horrific force. Al-Qaeda has denounced ISIS as being too radical. That's how horrific it is.
Yeah, that's saying something. And one thing I love, because you write nonfiction and fiction, one of the things I love about your fiction books, too, is while they're entertaining, they also make us think about and have a conversation about very important things. And you say there that we need to be thinking ahead. Who is that third target? And there's so much in that region that we can't ignore.
That's right. Well, you see, look, you've got over about 250,000 people are dead now in Syria. You've got the largest number of murders and deaths in Iraq this past year, 2014, since 2006, 2007. And it's getting worse because the Islamic State is literally beheading people, crucifying people, slaughtering people, selling little girls into sexual slavery. I mean, it's a horrific situation. And yet I'm concerned, Shannon, and one of the reasons I wrote the book is complacency. Too many political leaders are becoming complacent about how serious the threat is and the stakes. I mean, a year ago, the president told us that ISIS was not a threat. They were a JV team. Last summer, they said ISIS was engaged in genocide. Well, okay, if they're engaged in genocide, why is this such a slow-moving process to defeat them? And what the third target does, fictionally, is take us into a world in which they are not defeated, in which they capture chemical weapons, and then all hell breaks loose, far worse than what we currently see.
All right, Joel, it is fascinating. Always enjoy your books, but I always caution people, don't pick them up if you don't have time, because it's almost impossible to put them down. A new book out this week. Joel, thank you very much. Always great to see you.
Great to see you, Chan. Thanks.
What an incredible author. Joel Rosenberg wrote a book, I think it was about 6 years ago, the one that I can't put down. I continue to refer to. It's called Inside the Revolution. It's all about Iran. It's about the American hostages, the rise of Khomeini, the underground church in Iran, Christians in Iran. It's an excellent book, and every book Joel writes is so thought-provoking. It's so timely. He has a gift for writing. He's just an incredible author, an incredible Christian as well. He mentioned, of course, ISIS, and what are we doing about it? And I'm thinking tonight is the first presidential debate taking place in Cleveland, and we're going to see the front runner with 26% of the vote. He has captured the American heart, and I'm talking about Donald Trump. He's a man that is not a politician. You can't buy him. He has everything he needs. He could carry on this campaign for the next millennium and not run out of money. My point is, he is being so well received because he's not a politician. He speaks from the heart. He addresses the issues. He does have a plan to implement it. I'm very interested to see what Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Scott Walker will have to say about ISIS. What is this? What are we going to do about this militant terrorist group that is slaughtering Christians, kidnapping young Yazidi girls, selling them? What are we going to do about this? And I'm interested tonight. I hope you're going to watch these debates. I'm interested to hear what they're going to say about Iran and about ISIS, because there's no backing down on this. We need to be proactive and do something about this situation. And so if you get an opportunity, please watch these debates, because tonight might be a defining moment for the next year. We're getting close. It doesn't seem like that far away, but we are getting close to electing another president, and I hope and pray that we elect a strong, patriotic, tough leader who creates jobs, who stands up for our military. This is what we need. We need a strong leader. So I just wanted to throw that in for a couple extra cents that you watch the debates tonight. Now, Joel Rosenberg was just recently at Greg Laurie's church and was asked the question, what does Bible prophecy have to say about ISIS? And this is what he had to say.
I mean, this organization, ISIS, they've only come on our radar screens pretty recently. Of course, we've known about Al-Qaeda ever since 9/11. But now even Al-Qaeda feels that ISIS is going too far, which is kind of ironic when a group like Al-Qaeda, who are responsible for bringing down the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, would think this group is radical. But these guys use social media. They know how to get their message out. And their acts, these atrocities, these beheadings that they film and post. And I read recently that, 16 young boys were killed because they were watching a soccer game, and that was a violation of Sharia law. And they crucify people. And, of course, the massacre recently in France. And the list just goes on. Do you see ISIS or these Islamic groups in general, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, others, playing a role in Bible prophecy?
I do, and for several reasons. First, of course, Jesus warned that wars, rumors of wars, revolutions, these would be happening and intensifying in the last days before we get to his return, Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Mm-hmm. So we see that. We see the persecution of Christians in Matthew 24 is going to intensify, and Christians are under siege. I mean, not only are Christians being beheaded and crucified, I mean, bad enough, but little girls and little boys are being 8, 9, 10 years old are being sold into sexual slavery by ISIS. It's just horrific. But then you also have an interesting prophecy in John chapter 16, verse 2. It's often overlooked as a prophecy. Jesus said, "An hour is coming when those who kill you will believe they're doing this in service to God."
Yeah.
Now, that was true in the first century. Jewish leaders who hated the followers of Jesus persecuted, and so did the Romans. But I believe the hour has come now where we're seeing people who think they're doing it for God. Unfortunately, they're doing it to Satan. They're sacrificing Christians as blood sacrifices to their God. The other part is that we see the rise of all these countries surrounding Israel are going to try to attack and consume and savage Israel in the last days. And so a lot of judgments fall on the countries surrounding because their hearts are so wicked. Now, that's not true of every person in every country in that region yet, but if ISIS ends up, or a group like them, takes over control of that whole region as they want, this would be consistent with Bible prophecy.
Joel Rosenberg being interviewed by Greg Laurie on Bible prophecy and ISIS. Some insightful things. He talks about the persecution, the death, the martyrdom of Christians as Jesus prophesied, as he mentioned, Matthew 24, Luke 21, Mark 13, of course, comes into play there. And the interesting one in John 16, when they think they're doing this, they think they're doing it to please God, and actually they're not, of course. I want to talk just a second about a good friend of mine. When I think of ISIS and Assyrian Christians in Iraq, she's been on my radio program twice. She's a very strong and powerful voice for Assyrian Christians. I'm speaking of Narwin and Wea, and she has been so busy here lately with being on the Trinity Channel, being a champion of human rights, and being a voice for Assyrian Christians. And I just want to take the time to just say you will see her postings on my page. Please speak up and pray for her. She is relentlessly speaking out, and she works very hard, and I hope to have her back on my radio program for an update of all the things she's doing. She really needs our thoughts and prayers, and she needs our voices too. What's happening in Iraq is unprecedented. The displacement of Assyrian Christians, the death of Assyrian Christians, the Yazidis, it's unprecedented. So please keep her always in your thoughts and prayers. It's the 10 o'clock hour, and what I want to do now, I want to go to this very interesting interview from Janet Markell's radio program. She has very good authors on there. And this was recently done just a few days ago. Her guest was Gary Kaa. Had some insight to talk about this Iran nuclear deal. I want you to hear it right now on the cross in the desert.
I think we have to start with news that obviously broke some 10 days ago now, and that was the deal with Iran, the so-called nuclear agreement. Iran has been given a license to kill, as many have said, including Israel. Israel said this is a historic mistake for the entire world. Gary Kyle, let's start there, and then we're going to move on to these other issues that I outlined in my introduction. John Kerry, I believe, is delusional, as are many on the left. John Kerry says the U.S. got the good deal that we sought. Your thoughts on this?
Well, if it was up to me, there never would have been any negotiations with Iran because it's a terrorist state. And about once a month, literally about once a month, one of their leaders calls for the complete annihilation of Israel. So what in the world are we doing negotiating with a terrorist state that is sponsoring terror around the world? But if you are going to negotiate and you spend a couple of years doing it, you at least want to come away with something significant. But in this case, Iran pretty much got everything they wanted. Plus, they were able to continue with their nuclear program along the way over these last couple of years during these negotiations. So they're closer than ever to gaining their nuclear capacity. And if they do, they are the power most likely to use that capacity against Israel and possibly against the United States. I'm with Benjamin Netanyahu on this. I think the whole thing is a huge mistake. And unfortunately, I think it's going to provoke Israel to have to do something on its own. And I don't know how soon that will happen. Only God knows. But I kind of expect something within the next year or so that Israel will take some kind of action against Iran.
Absolutely.
I'd be surprised if they don't.
Absolutely. Iran proudly aired Barack Obama's speech to show the world of terror that the leader of the free world is on the side of terror, not just on the side of Islam, but on the side of terror.
You know, Jan, you would think with President Obama's Islamic background that he would know what kitman and taqiyya are.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two terms
mm-hmm.
within Islam about the deception and lying is the best word
mm-hmm.
that you do with the infidel for the cause of Islam. If Allah is being forwarded and Islam is being favored, if you lie about it, it's fine. That's part of Islam. That's exactly what's going on here. And, you know, to watch John Kerry with these folks at the bargaining table was more than I could handle, because this is just kitman and taqiyya in action as they lie and as they deceive, and we seem to smile and see nothing wrong with it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the left is setting up Armageddon for the world. I mean, they are committed to tyranny. They're committed to propping up the worst of the worst. They're supportive of every terror outfit on Earth, and if they could support terror organizations on other planets, I believe they would. I do not know how the left has gone so totally out of control, but they are. The problem is that Iran can do in 12 minutes to Israel what it took Hitler almost 12 years to try to do, and partially succeeded.
Jan, to me, it is stunning that we have people who claim to be Christians out there who see nothing wrong with what the left is up to. I mean, whose side are we on? We have to make a decision. Are we going to stand on God's side, or are we going to decide to stand on the side of those who want to destroy God's chosen people? It is stunning to me.
Part of what is happening is so many people, naive these days, don't see the end result down the road. They don't realize where all of this is headed. They're just loosely in favor of world peace and world unity, and they actually buy into the possibility of that occurring through these negotiations. They don't understand that the more chaos there is in the Middle East, the more terrorism there is around the world, the more the stage will be set to ultimately bring about this global government that is coming in the name of world peace, to bring in world peace. What's happening in the Middle East right now is friction on every front. You even have ISIS at odds with Hamas. You've got Iran in the mix. You have at least three or four evil Islamic radical groups even contending with each other for supremacy. And in the mix, thousands of people are dying in the Middle East.
That's right.
And the only thing they really have in common is a common hatred for Israel as well as the United States. And so at some point, this is going to come to a head. When that happens, there will be a significant bloodletting in the Middle East, even way beyond what we're seeing now. On the heels of such a conflict, the world, being naive as it is, will be prepared to buy into a proposal for world peace that includes some type of global government, and they will think that's the answer to the problem. This is the stage that Satan is very cleverly shaping.
Well, Gary Kah, and that's who I'm talking to for the hour, and you can learn more at GaryKah.org. You've kind of set up, and I was going to ask you, because very often you will come on this program and you will, you'll talk about the fact that the world needs a major crisis that's going to kick global government into reality. And we're going to talk about some other potential global crises here in the coming few minutes, but surely the stage has been set even more here back on, again, July 14th, when this treaty between, it's the P5 plus one. It's not just America. And guys, I would expect Russia and China to be as delusional as the current administration in Washington. But I am a little surprised. I believe France and Germany went along with this. Angela Merkel should know better. I mean, her country has been in the crosshairs of two world wars, and now she's going along with setting up a deal that's going to possibly ignite not just the Middle East, but Iranian nukes can touch into Western Europe in a nanosecond, and yet France and Germany are a part of this deal.
It's almost unbelievable. So many of the leaders of Western Europe, along with Barack Obama, are globalists, and they see the world getting smaller and that the United Nations needs to be empowered and that there needs to be some form of global government. And you wonder, in the backs of their minds, do they see the tension that this is going to create? Will it lead us closer toward world government? In other words, are they making this decision intentionally to try to create a world crisis? Or are they, like many of the world's people, simply naive? And I think only the Lord knows their hearts to that degree. But either way, the stage is being set. While I hate to set dates, I would be absolutely stunned if within the next couple of years, between now and the election, maybe shortly afterwards, if something huge doesn't happen in the Middle East because of the tension. You know, a year ago, ISIS was just revving up.
Mm-hmm.
And look at how far things have come. And now we've got over 1,000, possibly a couple thousand loyalists to ISIS in the United States getting ready to lunge forward. Recently, you had the son of a police captain in Massachusetts arrested for planning a major act of terror in the Northeast. And this was the son of a captain that was involved in rounding up the two young terrorists, you know, that caused the Boston Marathon bombings, and here his own son being involved in it. So we've got the enemy within now, and I truly am surprised that nothing bigger has happened thus far. I think the Lord has been very merciful, not allowing anything to occur yet, but I think he's being tested to the extreme when you look at the behavior of America on some of the moral issues recently and just on almost every front. It seems like we're losing control and the church is throwing in the towel and not standing where it needs to stand anymore on many of the issues.
That is Gary Kaw on the Janet Markell Understanding the Radio, or Understanding the Times radio broadcast. Some very interesting insights. In a nutshell, the chaos and the crisis that we see all around us here in Charleston, in Chattanooga, and just recently again in Nashville, theater shootings. We see this violence among us. We see it in the Middle East. And he says, that is Gary says, it's setting the stage for a global and or one world government, which will usher in a peace treaty. I'm speaking of Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, the Antichrist making a peace treaty with Israel. And, you know, this would be the pivotal thing to solidify the global government when there would finally be this peace treaty in the Middle East. The world would just think any person that was able to pull that off, any one individual in this organization that was able to make peace with Israel and her enemies and bring about this peace treaty, well, he must be an enlightened, God-given individual to have done that. In reality, the Bible says he is Antichrist. So some very insightful things from Gary Kaw on Janet Markell's Understanding the Times Radio. We got one more sound clip, very important for you to hear. This past January, I featured Bill Salas on my radio program talking about the nuclear showdown in Iran. This is a book that came out a couple of years ago, I believe, or at least a year and a half ago, prior to this nuclear deal on July 14th. But I want you to hear what he had to say just last year at this time before the deal was made. He's referring to a prophecy in Jeremiah chapter 49. I want to read it to you because this is very insightful. I've talked about this several times in my program. The word of the Lord that came to Jeremiah the prophet concerning Elam in the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, I will break the bow of Elam, the mainstay of their might, and I will bring upon Elam the four winds from the four quarters of heavens. And I will scatter them to all those winds, and there shall be no nation to which those driven out of Elam shall not come. I will terrify Elam, before their enemies and before those who seek their life. I will bring disaster upon them. My fierce anger, declares the Lord. I will send the sword after them until I have consumed them, and I will set my throne in Elam and destroy their king and officials, declares the Lord. But in the latter days, I will restore the fortunes of Elam, declares the Lord. Now, I'm going to let Bill flesh this prophecy out for you. I just want to make one statement. Bible prophecy has a miraculous way of speaking to the current context and then leaping across to a future context. It has a dual fulfillment. Case in point, Isaiah speaking to King Ahaz, that he will give a sign to King Ahaz. Behold, a virgin will be with child. That ultimately skipped over hundreds of years to the virgin birth of Christ, but it had a present-day context. It had a dual fulfillment. I believe this is speaking of ancient times in Elam and future times in Persia. Elam refers to Persia. And so this is very interesting. It also says that they will be scattered to the four winds. You have Iranians leaving Iran all over the world and becoming refugees, specifically since 1979. So I just wanted to make those insights to you, but right now I want to play this program from a year ago as Bill Salas talks about Jeremiah 49 and the nuclear showdown in Iran. Let's listen.
The basis of the book, Nuclear Showdown in Iran, Revealing the Ancient Prophecy of Elam, that's coming out heavily out of the reference in Jeremiah 49, verses 34 through 39 approximately. Few are talking about this until more recently, and you call this a vastly overlooked prophecy. Why is that?
Well, for several reasons, Jan. One is you're going to have a very hard time, as did I, finding any commentaries on it. I mean, there's just a handful of them out there, which, you know, compare that, like, for instance, that very popularized but very important prophecy by Ezekiel in chapter 38, where you'll have all kinds of commentaries and books written about that. If you go combing through the internet or the bookstores and libraries, you'll find hardly any commentaries on Elam. It's six verses. It's nestled in compactly between a historically fulfilled prophecy, and then it gets into, in chapter 50 and 51, you got the whole big Babylon thing. And everybody, of course, reads a lot about Babylon. That's a big mystique, if you will, but very important prophecies in Jeremiah 50 and 51. So it's sort of just tucked in and easy to overlook, and that, I believe that's what's happened. But it's a very important prophecy for our time, in my estimation.
I think what I'd like to do, you actually have a trailer on this book, which I always appreciate. Trailers don't necessarily have to be just for DVDs. I always like it when they come out with a trailer for a book. I'm going to play it. It's about 2 minutes, and then we'll play off of that trailer, because that's going to introduce a lot of questions.
By far the most important thing today, not only today, but in a historical perspective, the most important thing is to make sure that a militant regime, a militant Islamic regime or a militant Islamic movement, does not get its hands on the weapons of mass destruction.
Missiles cloud mid-east skies over the Persian Gulf. Iran shuts down the Strait of Hormuz. Arab oil is choked off to world markets. Hezbollah and Hamas launch scores of missiles into Israel. Terror cells initiate cycles of violence in America. About 2,600 years ago, the Hebrew prophets Jeremiah and Ezekiel issued parallel end times prophecies concerning modern day Iran. Today, the rogue country is becoming a nuclear nation and aggressively advancing its hegemony throughout the greater Middle East. Nuclear Showdown in Iran, Revealing the Ancient Prophecy of Elam, is a non-fiction thriller taking the reader on a journey of discovery through the eyes of the prophets and the minds of today's key national players. But there's a backstory, an even bigger story. It's a spiritual showdown in Iran between Islam and Christianity.
Iran is being transformed into a Christian nation in this generation. Iran has the fastest growing evangelical population in the world. And with the help of satellite television, millions of them are coming to Christ. 2 years ago, Iranian government began cracking down on Christianity. But it's not working. Christianity is growing in Iran. Iran is in the Bible prophecy, and many Iranian Christians are excited about what the Bible says about the future of Iran. Please pray for your brothers and sisters in Iran.
Okay, Bill Salas, I want to pick up on the end of that trailer first. Then we'll go back to the more ominous information that you write about and talk about in that trailer. But the sort of the revival in Iran, I actually played a clip of you a couple of weeks ago on my program with Bill Koenig talking about this as a minute or two clip. But help the listeners understand what on earth is happening that the Islamic Republic of Iran that America abandoned back in 1979, we abandoned the Shah of Iran, and then the mullahocracy rose up at that time, and being a Christian over there is next to impossible, and yet here we have a center of evangelical revival. What's going on?
Well, and that's really the amazing thing, Jan. You know, as I set out to write this book, I was not going to really focus on that, but I was so intrigued by it, and it became so vivid to me as I was writing the book. You know, it's, the narrator said the backstory is the bigger story. To me, that's what it is. There's good and bad news in this Jeremiah prophecy, and it ends with the good news. And we're seeing that God is doing an amazing work through supernatural means and meeting these people in Iran who are very disenchanted with Islam. You know, 60% of the population of Iranians over there are around 30 years old or younger. And that Islamic regime moved into power in 1979, about 35 years ago. And in year one, they went into an eight-year war of almost attrition with Iraq. And it's been downhill ever since. And they're realizing that the Islam that's being forced down their throats gives them no hope, no future, and they're very disenchanted with it. Now, the individual who is speaking on the end of the trailer is Hormoz Shariat of Iran Alive Ministries. Joel Rosenberg calls him the Billy Graham of Iran, and he has shared with me that through satellite television, millions are watching these programs in the Farsi-speaking languages. For instance, Iran is the number one evangelical population in the world. It's growing at an annual rate of 19.6% a year, and that's a Farsi-speaking language that is the satellite television is coming through. Now, Hormoz shared with me that before the revolution in 1979, there were about 500 professing Christians. Presently today, they estimate a minimum of 1 million, but they think more realistically, because it's very hard to get a consensus, that there's about 3 million to 5 million who are just coming to the Lord in multitudes. It's just an amazing backstory,
okay,
Jan.
Now, how is the government there dealing with this? Because that's a lot of people to crack down on. So are they overlooking it, or are they coming after them? Are they closing down their home fellowships? What?
Well, they're not appreciating it, to say the least. You know, it was a period before President Ahmadinejad was ruling. Now, of course, he's been replaced by Rouhani, Hassan Rouhani.
Right.
But where you could actually, I've been told, you could actually witness without too much persecution, and people were fairly receptive. But when Ahmadinejad got into power and they saw Christianity starting to burgeon exponentially, they started cracking down. And specifically, a couple years ago, they issued a decree to close all home churches, to imprison all pastors and to persecute all Christians. And so it's become a really big deal now. And you know, it's interesting the way they do it now is they actually kind of nestle into a friendship, get brought into a family's household through a series of seven stories, seven lessons, and they start taking them through Noah and Abraham. And they're very non-threatening to these families because those also have histories in the Quran and Islam. And then week seven, into the story, now they're talking to them about Jesus. And so it's a process that's been well put together in Iran and in other places as well to be able to get in and evangelize without being blatantly just talking about Jesus on day one. And it's very amazing how that's all working.
Bill Salas from his book, Nuclear Showdown in Iran, he's talking with Janet Markall and Understanding the Times Radio Broadcast. Just an amazing book. I highly recommend it, and it deals much more in depth with the Jeremiah 49 prophecy. But what Bill was talking about there is near and dear to my heart. The Christians in Iran need our prayer and support all the time. This is why I do this program. I send these links out to my Iranian friends all over the world, and through the miracle of this technology, they can, for the first time, find hope and freedom in Jesus. So it's such an honor to be able to do this program, to share it with my Iranian friends, to give them a hope and a freedom in Christ. Well, just recently, I wrote my newest blog. I haven't written blogs for several months because I've been so busy with my new book, Prisoner of Her Culture. But in light of this nuclear deal, I sat down and thought about this carefully. And this is what I wrote. It's called Money Talks. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And some people, craving money, have wandered from the true faith, piercing themselves with many sorrows. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10. Tailored suits, chauffeured cars, fine hotels and big cigars, up for grabs, up for a price. Come on, come on, love me for the money. Come on, come on, listen to the money talk. AC/DC, the Australian rockers from the land down under, several years ago cranked out a heavy metal anthem dealing with the deceptive and life ruled by the love of money. The chorus of the song, Money Talks, sums up the obsession and greed of human beings possessed by the love of money. Come on, come on, love me for the money. Come on, come on, listen to the money talk. In almost every area of life, money is powerful. Money is the final word. Money is the dark poison of greed that shapes and rules the human heart. On July 14, 2015, the P+5 meetings in Vienna concluded with a historical deal designed to transform Iran and the nations of the world. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif embraced and shook hands on a monumental agreement giving Iran a nuclear deal and billions of dollars in sanctions relief money. Missing from the agreement were the release of four American hostages: Iranian pastor and American citizen Saeed Abedini, ex-Marine Amir Hekmati, Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian, and former FBI agent Robert Levinson. The lives and well-being of four Americans had evidently been sacrificed on the altar of greed and legacy. The greedy Iranians were given a deal on a silver platter that, instead of curbing them from gaining a nuclear weapon, it paved the way for them to challenge the Middle East in the near future with weapons of mass destruction. In addition to the disastrous deal, President Barack Obama added to his crown another jewel stone marked Legacy, while Secretary of State John Kerry cleared a space on his living room wall shelf for a possible Nobel Peace Prize. Money, greed, power, and legacy has replaced the supreme value of human lives. In Iran, children are forced to work the streets because their parents are in prison, are addicted to drugs. Political prisoners are hanged almost every day. Journalists are imprisoned because of their opinion, and bloggers are silenced for speaking out against the government. The value of human beings and their rights are trampled on and crushed by the evil Iranian regime. And if Congress approves this nuke deal, then my country will be guilty of financing the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Approval of the nuke deal will line the pockets of the mullahs with billions of dollars in sanctions relief money, which they will use to enrich their nuclear capabilities and finance the spread of terrorism throughout the world through Hamas, Hezbollah in Syria, Yemen, and every part of the world. The innocent and suffering street children of Iran won't see a penny or atonement of relief from the sanctions money. Poverty and unemployment will continue to deteriorate the inner sanction of Iran. Human lives will suffer, prisoners will be executed, and the vicious cycle of death will continue for desperate Iranians. It was only a matter of a few weeks after the Iranian nuclear deal that the world was shocked by the Planned Parenthood scandal. A secret videotaped recording revealed two staff members discussing the sale of aborted fetus body parts and their profits over dinner. The soul of my nation has been corrupted and deceived by the love of money. The lives of four American citizens hang in the balance because of the greedy mullahs and their thirst for corruption and terrorism. Money talks. Listen to the money talk. The Bible warns us that the love of money is a disastrous deception that enslaves the human heart and corrupts its thinking. When money is at the center, it becomes a deadly idol that will imprison and torture the human soul. Once that happens, the value of humanity is sacrificed in exchange for the lust of material wealth. However, money can't buy real love and happiness. Money is temporal. It will soon fade away, and then what is left? People suffer and die, and money won't prolong a single day of their lives, but only true love will. There is a magnificent mausoleum and shrine in Tehran, Iran, housing the tomb of Ayatollah Khomeini. It is a beautiful architectural design with a gold dome, stained glass, supported by 8 marble columns, and a lavish decorated interior of white marble floors and fine carpets. The mausoleum is a tribute to the legacy of a Khomeini, a dictator who ordered the massacre of 30,000 political prisoners in 1988 and enslaved the lives of billions of Iranians under the oppression of Sharia law. The wealth of Iran stands in tribute to Khomeini instead of feeding the thousands of suffering and starving homeless people who struggle for survival every day. Money talks. Money rules. Money deceives. God has given us wealth to help the oppressed, to feed the hungry, to educate the poor, to bring hope and healing to the sick and needy. Money is not evil. The human heart is. The only cure for the idol of wealth is a heart that is healed by the love and forgiveness of Christ. Christ came to heal the brokenhearted and to set the prisoners free. When Jesus is the Lord of our lives, then money is put in the right perspective. Our whole lives, including our wealth, belongs to God, and then we are free to be generous with it. It is no longer our slave master. Christians are called to be the greatest examples of charity and generosity. Christians are not enslaved to the god of money. Several years ago, the band AC/DC wrote a rock ballad about the deceit of money. Don't let the love of money rule your heart. Take one look at Iran, and you will see the tragic result of greed and corruption. Instead, let the love and compassion of God rule your heart, and then you will be free to use money for the hope and healing of suffering humanity. My latest blog, Money Talks. My dear friend Payman A., who is a guest on my show now and calls in from Malaysia, has a real gift for writing, and she is my goddaughter. I respectfully call her that because she's that near and dear to my heart. Just recently, we talked about the sale of kidneys in Iran, that Iranians do this for money. They have to achieve wealth in some way when the economy is so horrible. And they don't have a waiting list for kidneys in Iran because it's such a fruitful market. Iran is the only country where the selling and buying of kidneys is legal. As a result, there is no shortage of the organs. But for those trying to sell a kidney, well, there's a lot of competition. Just one example, Marzea, in order to advertise her kidney for sale, has written her blood type and her phone number on pieces of paper and has posted them along the street, close to several of Tehran's major hospitals. That's where the home of the kidney transplant centers are. Others have done the same. They have written in big letters or in bright colors to attract attention. Some have sprayed their information on the walls of public or even private properties. Kidneys for sale, carrying the blood donor's type, and on it goes. Well, my dear friend Payman A. wrote this brief little story about sometimes the injustice of this kidney sale in Iran. And she writes, in the beginning, everything was a joke. My sister and I always said, let's sell our kidneys to live like a human being. The money for kidneys was not much, but it was the amount that we never had before. Now, I don't want to sell mine. I want to keep it to donate it to you if you need one. We were always thankful that God created us healthy, but everything changed when he did that. A strong, tall, athletic man in our neighborhood, caring neighbor. The sadness in his face showed his suffering inside. He needed a job. One day, we saw him selling fruits in our street. Wow, great. Finally, he could start a business. He had a job now, but he had to lose one of his kidneys for that. He would not have those fruits and the push cart. They costed him his kidney and his health. There was no other way. He needed to take care of his family. His situation was not bad, and the neighbors tried to support him buying fruits for him. We shouldn't. Why shouldn't we do that? See, he is still working outside with one kidney, I thought. I just needed a lie to justify my absence in the house. I did not want my sister to do what I wanted to do. I wanted her always to be sound and healthy. Everything was done fast. I was the second victim of poverty, the victim of the government who could not support me, the victim of the culture who made marriage and life after marriage so hard and expensive. So I did it secretly. But it was not possible to hide it. My father's back and my mother's heart broke when they found out what I did. My father preferred to die because of all he could not do for us. My sister repeated the story. She sold her kidney too, so that we could open a small place business. The things did not go the way we expected, and it was not in our control. In spite of his satisfactory business, the young neighbor committed self-immolation because the municipal officers, the units of barrier, crushed all his fruit and all of his investment because they accused him of blocking the people's road with his pushcart and fruit stand. There was no hope for him. He did not have another kidney to sell. All his life and hope was in that kiosk where he sold fruits, and it was all crushed in less than a minute. And then, in hopelessness, he committed self-immolation. He set himself on fire. My father lost his kidney, and we could not donate to him, one, because we did not have another one. We cannot get married because nobody wants to bear the possible problems of a wife with just one kidney. We had to change jobs 3 times because people are getting poorer and poorer, and they cannot afford buying much. First, then we had to change our shop from arts and crafts to dressmakings. Then we had to dismiss our employees who made clothes. I own a small dressmaking shop. Now we had to stop cooking meals and just stay home frying onions and garlics and veggies. While we have lost a lot of money from our kidneys due to all the changes, we did not sell our kidneys. We wasted them. We lost our life. We learned that if you are poor in Iran, you are likely to be poorer forever if you want to live in an honorable way. I just wonder how the poor heads and mullahs and government officials get so rich in a very short time, pretending they have a simple divine life. Why couldn't we do that? Well, as you heard in my blog, Money Talks, you know why. Khamenei pointing out this practice in Iran of organ donation, of the selling of kidneys for money, and in some situations, the drastic results of doing that. So I think she's bringing us awareness of the deplorable situation that goes on in Iran. Some may argue, well, there are thousands of people here in the U.S. just waiting for kidneys. And yes, in one sense, this is a wonderful practice. It's legal to donate that in Iran. Why not here? But then you see some of the horrible tragedies of doing this practice. It's very competitive in Iran. It's very controversial. Now, what happens after the transplant is the vendor is compensated by the government and the recipient. In 2010, a total of 2,285 kidney transplants took place in Iran. And so this goes on and on. But be very, very careful. The spread of disease, the failure of kidney transplants, and what happens if something goes wrong in your life and you don't have another one to sell for money? Can you really live with just one kidney? Does your health decline? These are lots of issues. But again, the bottom line is the selling of kidneys because of the economic woes in Iran. Please keep my Iranian friends in your prayers. I'm going to be teaching you today from the book of Revelation, chapter 2, about Jesus, our first love. And I want to set the stage by playing this beautiful song by Hillsong. It's called Christ is Enough. Let's listen right now on the cross in the desert.
All of my devotion. Now there's nothing in this world that could ever satisfy. Through every trial, my soul will sing, no turning back. I've been set free. Christ is enough for me. Christ is enough for me. Everything I need is in you. Everything I need. Christ, my all in all. The joy of my
thought-provoking music of Hillsong and Christ is Enough. Christ is enough. Is he your treasure? Is he who you long for every day? Well, if most of us are honest and admitted our love for Christ wanes, it's kind of up and down. And the pressures of life, the circumstances of life, the trials of life, sometimes instead of becoming better, we become bitter. And so it's important to always return to your first love. And it's the subject of my message for today. The book of Revelation is one of my favorite books. And while we can talk about all the wrath of God, the coming return of Christ, the millennium, the Mark of the Beast, and all the things that are part and parcel of the book. I love the seven letters to the churches. It's so important that we hear what Christ has to say to the church. John was given a mission on the Isle of Patmos, where he was exiled by the Emperor Domitian. And part of that mission was to write these corrective letters to the churches of his time, which I think transcends to our time as well. One of the letters, one of the first letters, is written to the church at Ephesus. Do now is read this brief letter and talk to you about coming back to your first love. Write this letter to the church in Ephesus, Revelation chapter 2, verse 1. This is the message from the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand, the one who walks among the seven golden lampstands. Jesus says, I know all the things you do. I have seen your hard work and your patient endurance. I know you don't tolerate evil people. You have examined the claims of those who say they are apostles, but they are not. You have discovered they are liars. You have patiently suffered for me without quitting. But I have this complaint against you. You don't love me or each other as you did at first. Look how far you have fallen. Turn back to me and do the works you did at first. If you don't repent, I will come and remove your lampstand from its place among the churches. But this is in your favor. You hate the evil deeds of the Nicolaitans, just as I do. Anyone with ears to hear must listen to the Spirit and understand what he is saying to the churches. To everyone who is victorious, I will give fruit from the tree of life in the paradise of God. A little bit about the background of the Ephesian church. It's the capital of Asia, which was the western part of Asia Minor. In the time of the Romans, it bore the title of the first and greatest metropolis of Asia. It was distinguished for the Temple of Diana, who there had her chief shrine in Ephesus. It had the largest theater in the world, capable of containing 50,000 spectators. It was, like all ancient theaters, open to the sky. Here were exhibited the fights of wild beasts and of men with beasts. Ephesus is located in modern-day Turkey, and the population is estimated at 3 million. It was a terminal at that time for carnival routes, or caravan routes, excuse me, from Europe and the Orient. The history of Ephesus really dates back to about 1044 BC under the Grecian Empire. It became part of the Roman Empire at 133 BC, and it was, of course, popular for athletic events. Paul was supposed to have started the church there, but some say that the Apostle Paul visited Ephesus for the purpose of exhortation and making sure they had good leadership, but he was not the one that founded the church there. It was founded 40 years before John wrote this letter to the church. And, of course, in Ephesus, they had their work cut out because of idolatry, because of Diana, the goddess that was worshipped there. And, of course, the book of Ephesians was a letter to the churches written by Paul. What was going on in Ephesus was sexual immorality. That was the trademark at Ephesus. And it was really a big part of Eastern religions at that time. All idolatrous religions participated in this sexual immorality, as does many false religions. And so this was the background of the church at Ephesus. And Jesus commends them. He says that he knows how hard they do their work, and you're a patient endurance. But he says, you don't love me or each other as you did at the first. If you look throughout the Bible and the pages of Scripture, this was the ongoing problem with the children of Israel. And we see that God zealously loved them, and he wanted them to love him in the same way. And in the first three chapters of Jeremiah, God laments forsaking your first love. He says, I will pronounce my judgments on my people because of their wickedness in forsaking me, in burning incense to other gods, and in worshiping what their hands have made. I remember the devotion of your youth, God writes. How as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert. Has a nation ever changed its gods? Yet they are not gods at all, but my people have exchanged my glory for worthless idols. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. God laments, what happened to you? You were my bride at one time. You loved me. You followed me. But what happened is they exchanged God for the temptation of worthless idols. And God laments that they've committed these two sins. You're not drinking from the fountain of real water anymore, but from these broken cisterns. It's hard to imagine that these Christians in Ephesus had fallen into this sin. Because Jesus, first of all, commends them for their hard work in exposing false apostles, speaking out against evil. And then, I guess, as the pastor of the Ephesian church is reading this letter, he's saying, we're doing good, right? And then he reads the next line where Jesus says, I have a complaint against you, Ephesus. You don't love me. You don't love each other as you did at the first. What they were doing was going through the motions of doing the right things. But all of that is meaningless without love. And we hear that echoed when Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, if I speak all the languages of earth and of angels but don't love others, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and I understand all of God's secret plans and possess all knowledge, and if I had such faith that I could move mountains but don't love others, I would be nothing. Even if I gave everything to the poor and sacrificed my body, I could boast about it, but if I didn't love others, I would have gained nothing. The supremacy of love had somehow leaked away from these Christians at Ephesus. And they could say, I love Jesus, look at my good works, but their hearts had become cold. God says to his children, it's forsaking me. Now, in some cases, the children of Israel would offer incense to other gods. Remember when Moses went up to commune with God in Exodus chapter 33, there was a party down below. He hadn't returned for so long, and they engaged in this pagan festival and praise. They had exchanged their love, their burning love for God, to worthless idols. And Jesus says, I have this against you. And here's the solution. Turn back to me and repent. Do the works that you did at first. When we find that our hearts have gotten cold, that our zeal for good works is there, but our heart of devotion is missing, then God calls us to come back to him. It's like in a marriage, if you think about it. You hear about these stories all the time. They are so much in love. At the wedding, they couldn't take their eyes off of each other. And then, within a few years, the love has gotten cold. And you can see that in marriages. You can be busy working at your jobs, busy decorating the house, busy raising kids, busy as can be, but your love has waned and gotten cold. Why does that happen? I think it's because we're so busy that we fail to sit down with the one that we claim to love and just talk and commune with him. You will hear the experts say the number one problem in marriage is lack of communication. In most marriages, outwardly, it looks very successful. They're very successful. They're doing all these good works. They're busy. But when you find out beneath the surface that they barely talk to one another, and so their hearts have grown cold. And in the same way, we can do that with our relationship with Jesus. We can be so busy with our religious rituals that we've left our first love. And Jesus points this out for their spiritual welfare. You will notice in every one of these letters, there's accommodation and then there's a correction. Because Jesus loves the church. He died for the church. He gave his life for his people. That because he loves us, he wants to point out what the real problem is. And the problem is that loss of intimacy. You see, it's easy to do. All of us get busy. We pride ourselves in being so religiously busy. But here is something to think about. In all of your busyness, do you spend time just talking to God, pouring out your heart to him, and tell him that you love him? Not because of what he has done for you, but because of who he is. Let's get back to our first love as a song. I remember by a band that played at our church called Liberty, and it was such a thought-provoking song. I wrote a song a while back called First Love. And God is calling his bride to come back to him, to come back to the intimacy they once had with him, to that one-on-one where you're before the Lord and that you just pour out your heart to him. And you recognize that this is a love relationship, that Christianity is not just a working, dynamic performance of doing what is right, but that Christianity is a real, tender-hearted love relationship with Jesus our Savior. When our focus becomes on the work of our hands and on the ministry that we're involved in, when our focus drifts onto that, it should be a wake-up call to what is happening here. You know, the Bible is full of admonitions about this. And I'm thinking, as I turn the pages, one of the last things that John writes, who is the same author of the book of Revelation, one of the last things that he writes in the epistles of John is very insightful about this whole problem. And I want to read that to you. 1 John chapter 3. Let's go there. Dear friends, guard yourself from idols. That's true. Guard yourself from idols. What does John say that for? Because the heart is an idol-making factory. And we are tempted to praise the works of our hands more than anything. John says, my joy is that you walk in the truth. Walk in the truth. When we're walking in intimacy with God and walking in the truth, then our fire will be red hot for Jesus. John talks an awful lot in his epistles about love and truth. And the rebuke to the Ephesian church was, you're doing good works, but you're missing out on the most important part of your Christian life. You don't love me like you did at the first. Do you sometimes feel that way? Sometimes I do. Sometimes I think about, wait a minute, where is that intimate time with God? I seem like everything else has become more important than spending time with him. And what about the way that I talk and treat others? Why do I feel this bitterness in my soul? What's going on? If we know anything about the Bible, it is a corrective teaching. And we don't want to fall into the same error as the Ephesians. And so one way we can keep from happening is that we make sure that our intimate time with God is a regular thing we do. And that we are not so busy with the work of our hands that we don't stop and talk to God. And you know, it's just like a marriage. Don't get so caught up in your busy life that you forsake that intimate time with your husband or wife. And this is because we are the bride, and Jesus is the bridegroom. And so let's don't forsake talking with him, fellowshipping with him, spending those intimate moments with him. And that will guard our hearts from becoming cold, from becoming callous. Now, some of you might be listening that Jesus is not your first love at all. And I admonish you today to know the God of the universe, who is the greatest lover of all. He pursues us with his irresistible love. And if you don't know Christ, today is the day to know him, to bow your head before him, to just turn from your sin and repent and embrace his love and forgiveness. It is a gift. His love is a gift given to you, a gift that you can never earn. Precious, precious gift. And Jesus will change your life. He will come into your heart and make you into a brand new person. He forgives all of your shame, all of your guilt, everything. His love washes it all away, and you are white as snow. Though your sins be as scarlet, they will be as white as snow. I want to thank you today, my dear friend Patricia, for meeting with me on the cross in the desert, for coming in the chat room. My dear friend Patricia is a very faithful, supportive listener, and I appreciate you, Patricia. My thoughts, my prayers are with you and your situation with your husband at home. I'm praying for you, and don't think for a second that God isn't working in your situation, that he is a good God, and that he is going to bring about a good out of everything that you've gone through. I want to thank you for listening today to The Cross in the Desert. I want to remind you that on my Facebook page, if you scroll down, is a petition to sign today and to say no, tell Congress no to this nuclear deal. It's so, so important that we stand up for Saeed and Amir and the prisoners in Iran. Let's take a stand for them. Let's don't forget about them and all of the politicking. I want to say thank you so much for coming today to The Cross in the Desert. It is a pleasure to always be here and to be a voice of hope and freedom for Iranians. And next Monday, we'll be back with another program. I pray that you have an incredible weekend. And please watch the presidential debates tonight. Please do that. God bless you. I will see you on the next Cross in the Desert very, very soon.
My nights are filled.